everyone. Thanks for coming. It's always nice to be here at Holden, and I really enjoy the opportunity to be up in these wonderful surroundings. And thanks to Sharon, who's over in the corner, for all her hard work getting us to come up here in this great program. And also, I don't know about you, but I'm having a hard time getting to everybody I want to hear, so I'm very appreciative of the fact that you came tonight. I have a three-part series, and the first part last night was just to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien and his life a little bit, and also to visit with, think about how, what sorts of influences were in his life that made him what I'm going to ask in the next lecture on Thursday night is the question of, there's a debate about whether Tolkien and Lewis are really ecologists, because they're so early in, well before anybody really was talking about or using the term ecology or ecologists. And so there's a debate, are they or are they not? And I'm going to talk about that on Thursday. But I thought for both of these people, their lives are so interesting, and learning something about their lives. And I think there's some overlap. And if you were here at the Tolkien lecture, you'll notice the overlap, and I'll make some hints to some of that as I go through Lewis's life, and as we visit about C.S. Lewis. So I'm going to talk about his life, and I'll hint at some ecological concerns and things that were important in his life and in his writings. And then we'll go on and talk. I'll draw this all together in some sort of big conclusion on Thursday, but basically I'm just trying to figure out who Lewis was. And I especially tonight want to talk about Lewis's idea of and his concept of joy. Lewis is a really interesting human being, and a lot of biographies have been written about him, unlike Tolkien, who only really has Carpenter's biography and a few other books that are really quite good about Tolkien in World War I, which is focused on a part of his life. Lewis has zillions of biographies, and part of that has to do with Lewis's very complicated and interesting life journey. And one of the things he does is he has an autobiography. He writes about his own life, which is unlike Tolkien, who said The Lord of the Rings was his biography. Lewis actually writes it, but I'll talk about that in a sec. On September 8th in 1947, a few years after the war was over, Tolkien graced the cover of Time magazine as one of the most influential people in the world at that time. It's mind-boggling that an Oxford Don, a professor, a scholar of medieval studies, and I'm a medievalist myself, in large part because I love Tolkien, in part because I love Lewis, and I wanted to read what they had read and before they started writing their mythologies and their stories, which had so profoundly shaped my life. 1947 is pretty early because notice that if you know anything about Lewis, he had not written the Chronicles of Narnia yet. So he's already gaining a great deal of popularity, and we will see why that is. He asks a very simple question of his life in his biography. And his question is, what is joy? Where does it come from? And where does it go after it makes very brief visits to us in our lives? This is his quest to find out, and I would like to share that journey with you. Well, the reason Lewis was popular in the 1940s was for two reasons. He did a radio broadcast series, which eventually would become a book called Mere Christianity. But his book, The Screwtape Letters, was very, very popular. And so that's how he wound up on the cover of Time magazine. But he still had his best books to write yet, and one of those would be his autobiography. I recommend a couple books to you about Lewis. If you're more scholarly and want to dive into really nitty-gritty detail stuff, Alistair McGrath's recent biography of Lewis is quite good, and it's very, very detailed. And it kind of reads like a scholarly book at times. You know, it kind of goes into heady details, and maybe that's not quite your thing. If you want a very readable and a wonderful book, I recommend Alan Jacobs' The Narnian and The Life and the Imagination of C.S. Lewis. It's really a wonderful read, and there's lots of other wonderful sorts of biographies out there that you can really enjoy. But we're going to focus Like last night, a lot of my information came from Humphrey's biography. Tonight, I'm going to spend most of my time just looking at C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life. The book was written in 1955. It was written at the same time he was writing The Chronicles of Narnia. A lot of people have pointed out that there's many episodes in his life that come through into his stories of Narnia. And what he does in the introduction of this, I think, is quite interesting. What I'd like to do is just read you a little bit about that. Lewis was asked, because of the popularity, now in 1955, at this time, he's already starting to write The Chronicles of Narnia. They're flying off the shelves. Tolkien's books are now coming out. The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit have been out for a while. They became wildly popular, and so his publisher came to him and said, "We want you to write an autobiography." And Lewis said, "I'm not interested in doing that. I'm not going to write an autobiography." But they eventually kind of convinced him to do it. And so in his opening to his book, he notes this. This is his comment: "How far the story that I'm about to write to you about my autobiography, my journey, how far the story matters to anyone but myself, really only depends upon the degree to which others have experienced what I call joy. If it is at all common, a more detailed treatment of joy than has, I believe, ever been attempted before may be of use. In other words, my publishers want me to tell my life story, and I will do that, but I'm not interested in telling my life story. I'm interested in exploring the question of joy." And so, in other words, he tells you his life story, but he deliberately tells us that he's leaving out many important things, most of which are in his later life, some of which become quite controversial, and I'll point some of those things out as we go along the way. But what he's really interested in is exploring the question of joy. And so when we get into the early part of the novel, or of his autobiography, Lewis immediately starts telling us, I mean, the opening lines to his book just kind of give it away. He even says, and by the way, if you start this book and you start reading it and you find it boring, I suggest you quit. And which he really didn't think his book would have any resonance with people. Other than those people, he says, unless they may have heard the horns of Elfland, maybe then you might be interested in what I have to say. So Lewis opens by saying, "I was born in 1898 in Belfast, Ireland. One of England's greatest authors was not born in England." Remember, Tolkien wasn't born in England either. Technically, their families were both English, but Tolkien's father, Albert, was a barrister, a lawyer, a clerk, working in Belfast. His mother was a mathematician. She taught math, but she also had a great facility with languages. Now notice some parallels between Tolkien and Lewis. She starts teaching Lewis languages, especially French, at an early age. He starts learning Latin. He becomes very interested in Greek. Well, a lot of parallels between Tolkien and Lewis. But it's interesting when he starts talking about his education and about his upbringing. This is what he says starts it all off. "Once, in those very early days of my life," and it's hard to know how old he was when this event happened, but most people think he was 3 or 4. "And one of those early days, my brother, Warney," his brother's name was Warren, he only had one brother, his brother was a few years older than him, "my brother brought into a nursery a little toy garden that he had affixed to a biscuit tin, which he had covered with moss and garnished with twigs and flowers, as to make a true toy forest, or what I call a toy garden. that was the first beauty I ever knew. Well, he grew up in fairly, unlike Tolkien, Tolkien, who grew up in poverty because his father and mother died at a young age, Tolkien grew up in a nice house. This is Little Lee in Belfast. You can go, still go visit the place. But it's this toy garden that kind of hooks Lewis. This interesting little tin, I just found this on the web. I couldn't find anything in a biscuit tin that looked like it. But so he has this toy garden, and he's kind of wondering about it. Many years later, he's haunted by this idea of this toy garden, and he writes about it. He says, after we had moved away from our house, one day, I was walking by a flowering currant bush on a summer day. Now, he's still a fairly young kid. Now, notice, Lewis and Tolkien both know the names of all the plants that they're around. So they have this interesting relationship. His mother was a gardener. She taught him the love of plants and things like that as well. So he's walking by a flowering currant bush one day, and suddenly, without warning, and as if from the depths, not out of years, but of centuries, the memory of that earlier morning at the old house, when my brother had brought his toy garden into the nursery, it came rushing back to me. Mm. It is difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation which came over me, but Milton's, from Paradise Lost, Milton's enormous bliss of Eden maybe comes close to it. Mm. It comes somewhere near the mark. It was a sensation, a chorus of desire. But a desire for what? Not certainly for a biscuit tin filled with moss. Not even, though it does come into mind, for my own past. But before I knew what I desired, the desire left me. Mm-hmm. It was gone. I found myself longing for longing that had just ceased. I long for longing. The desire itself, the longing that he had, was what he wanted. Not the thing that he was longing for at that time. It's an interesting observation. I suspect that at this moment, some of you may understand what I'm getting at. This whole notion of like the toy gardens. He goes on to suggest that the longing he had, this is a drawing of the Castlereagh Hills, which Lewis could see from his bedroom window in Little Lee. He said he also started having this sort of longing for what was beyond those mountains. And remember in Tolkien, he wrote that story, Leif by Niggle, and he had those mountains that he's longing for. And Tolkien and him had the same sort of wonder about longing, about beauty, about what was out there. Lewis said that this idea of joy is not nostalgia. It is an ache in the heart. It is a feeling of the great bittersweet, he said. And then he goes on to say that when he was just six, he became what he calls the votary of the blue flower. The votary of the blue flower. Now, he's speaking in terms that somebody who's reading this story along, you know, if you're not really interested in figuring out what joy is, you're not going to follow Lewis's story. So he's really trying to discourage people to read his own book in the first chapter, right? And so you have to kind of start figuring out what he means. And Lewis says, if I want to become a votary of the blue flower, I am seeking Sehnsucht. Now you're really ready to put the book down, right? He's starting to quote German, you know, he's talking about German philosophy, and you want to say, okay, I'm done. Now, Sehnsucht, according to the 19th century British poet Matthew Arnold, Sehnsucht is a wistful, tearful longing and ache which is a joy that is greater than happiness. It is not happiness. It is more than that. It is longing. And so what is Sehnsucht? Well, for Lewis, it was a longing not just for the longing, although the longing is important, right? It's this feeling, it's a moment in your life when you start, well, you can't really explain it. And I'm going to try. And if I try to explain it, I'm going to kill it, but I'm going to try. Okay, so let's go there. So modern psychologists have talked about Sehnsucht, and they talk about it as having a certain, this feeling has certain qualities. Let's say, now I'm going to suggest that I have had this sense of joy in my life. I know you all have had it too, but I'm going to use a simple example for me to help you try to understand it. There's many times in life when you have joy, but they're very, this moment that you have, this moment of joy, is fleeting. It happens quickly. It doesn't last long. And as soon as you realize that you're having it, it's gone. But as long as you stay in the moment and you let the moment exist, it is a beautiful and wonderful thing. And what is that moment? When my first child, my son Jeremiah, filmmaker now in LA, when he was born, the first time I held the baby, my own child, in my arms, I felt Sehnsucht. I felt that sort of longing. What is it? Well, it's a hope. When I held my child, I felt like I wanted the world to be right. I want the whole world just to have peace and compassion so that I can just let my son, send my child off into this world and everything will be good. It's a hope for an ideal. A sense of incompleteness and the imperfection of life. As I held my son, I thought, oh, dear God, just let's keep him safe for the rest of his life. And then when he turned 5 and it was about the time his forehead got hard because he kept running into things, you know, when I just kept thinking, you know, I hope he survives his young foolishness, because he was a crazy man, right? But there's a sense in which there's an incompleteness in life. I'm bringing this child into a world that I don't know will be the best world for him. But I still hope for it. I still long for it. So notice how these tensions are starting to work inside of us. And a living in the present in which the past and the future are both closely tied. Everything that was wrapped up in my son as I'm holding him for the first time, I'm completely kind of lost in him. And I am having all these sorts of deep emotions. And some of the emotions are, I kind of now, for the first time, I think I understand what my parents felt for me. And then my relationship to my parents changed dramatically in the moment that my son was born. And I can't really explain that, so the past is rushing in, and I'm hoping for the future, and he's now married, and I'm longing for a grandchild from him. And all of a sudden, all that is wrapped up in that baby, in a moment, in a flash of time. It's bittersweet in its emotions because I know I can't protect him from the world. And I want him to have all the best that the world can offer at the same time. It's a reflection on life that makes sense of the rest of existence. Somehow holding my son for the first time and feeling that sense of joy gave meaning to everything else. I was in the parish in Wilson, North Dakota at the time, and thinking about going off to graduate school. And, you know, you're caught up in all this sort of busyness and that, and all of a sudden work didn't seem to matter that much anymore to me. I mean, I loved what I did. I liked being a pastor. I liked doing the work. But at the same time, now I have this child, and, well, the rest of life suddenly came into perspective. I didn't want to be a workaholic. I didn't want to be the kind of person that I sometimes could easily be. I worked too hard at times, ask my wife, she'll tell you. And there's a symbolic richness given to objects in this life. So in this case where I'm talking about my son, that I mean, it's hard to talk about him as an object, but I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity where sometimes for me it happens here at Holden all the time. Like this morning, and my wife and I went for a walk, and we came on 5 deer kind of standing there. And it's just like, you know, you have this the moment of that object, of those deer being there, is gives a whole new richness and beauty to life. Wanting to kind of preserve this sort of landscape in this wilderness, but I know that climate change is creating a problem for that. Now, I don't know if that quite helps you a little bit, because one of the problems is that Lewis says, I want to be a votary of the blue flower. and so he's talking about Zainzuk. And this really comes from a book by George Philip Frederick, who took the pen name of Novalis. And he was writing this book, Heinrich von Oftendingen, a pretty exciting title. He was a very young man. He was 29 years old when he died. But in this book, he talks about this idea of coming upon a flower, a blue flower, a flower that's simply so beautiful that it takes his breath away. And for a moment, he has this sort of sense of longing or depth in that's going on in this life. And so Novalis says that what he wants to do is become a votary of the blue flower. The idea is that he wants to seek beauty in life, because if you seek beauty and are lost in the beauty of life, that's when those moments of joy come upon you. You cannot control joy. You can only experience it, says Lewis. And so you can't even really go out and look for it. You can't do anything to force it into your life. It happens, and when it does, those are the great gifts of life that make life worth living. And whether it's a baby in arms, or there'll be other sorts of examples that I can give you. So remember the votary, the blue flower. I'm going to come back to this whole idea in just a minute. But it's basically a longing for beauty. Well, when we look at Jack's life, Lewis, at a young age, declared that he did not want his name to be Clive Staples. That was his name, Clive Staples Lewis. He did not want to be called Clive anymore. He said, I want to be called Jaxie. His father said, but that's the dog's name. He said, he refused to answer after the age of four. He refused to answer to any other name than Jaxie or Jack. And that's how he got it, and he was always prone to giving nicknames to other people as well, especially like Tolkien and whom we call Tollers and others. And we'll talk about that more. But there was his mother and his father over in the back, and they had servants in the house. And a little bit like Tolkien early on when they had moved to South Africa, there were some servants, and then when his father died, they had some difficulty. And he was incredibly close to his brother, life seemed to be going along very well for Lewis. Lewis says that he is a product of big empty hallways, being able to play outside in nature freely. Sounds familiar. Tolkien had that same sort of opportunity to get out into nature. And he and his brother had wild imaginations, and his parents let them read whatever books there were, and they had tons of books, but they really didn't have what he called the right books. They didn't have a lot of good fantasy books or stories like Lewis Carroll or things like that, but they read a lot and they got along pretty well. But a lot like Tolkien, Lewis too would encounter a fair amount of tragedy at a very early age. At the age of nine, Lewis one night tells in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that mother, he had a toothache, and you can imagine this little guy, you know, running down to his mother, to going into her bedroom to help, you know, Mom, I've got a toothache, can you help me with this? And he walks into the room, and his mother had been kind of ill off and on, but she hadn't said anything to him. What he didn't know is that she had cancer, and advanced stages of cancer. And this night, when he goes into the room with the toothache, she's in the final stages of life and dies later that night. And Lewis was completely undone by this. This is his description of his mother's death. When her case was pronounced hopeless, I remembered what I had been taught, that prayers offered in faith would be granted. I accordingly set myself to produce by willpower a firm belief that my prayers for her recovery would be successful. And as I thought, I had achieved it. She died. The thing hadn't worked. I had approached God, or my idea of God, without love or without awe or even without fear. I thought he was merely a magician. With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, some pleasures, a few stabs of joy. Notice that description. Joy is like a stab of a knife. A few stabs of joy, but I had no more security. It was all sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis. Lewis's father, sadly enough, was incapable of dealing with the death for a few reasons. One of the reasons was that Lewis's grandfather, Albert's father, had been living with him for some time. He was ill, and when Flora became ill, the father asked the grandfather to move out for a while because they needed nursing help and he needed people staying in the house. And so they put him in a nursing home. He said, just for a while till she gets better. They put him out, and father was so heartbroken that he died a week later. Flora would die a few weeks after that. And then, oddly enough, Albert's brother died unexpectedly a few weeks after that. He had three major deaths within the period of a month, and he was incapable of dealing with the boys. 2 weeks after Flora died, Albert sent Warney and Jack to England to go to boarding school. Lewis was devastated. Part of the devastation was the fact that Lewis was placed into a school not unlike Hogwarts, if you know the Harry Potter series. The school was run by a man named what he called Oldie. Later, after a year, the man was committed to an insane asylum because he was crazy. And so that was his first experience of being away from home, of being with a crazy schoolmaster. So then he was shipped off to another school where he had to make more friends. And slowly he talks about this period as being extremely difficult. They picked on him. He had thumbs that were frozen in place, so he couldn't bend his thumbs. So he was horrible at athletics. He was big, he was clumsy, and he said, I had a face that everybody wanted to say, wipe that smile off your face. You know, he had one of these looks that, you know, the older kids would always pick on him. And he said he had a horrible time. He was incredibly bright, he was always the teacher's favorites, and that didn't endear him to other friends, right? Other people didn't want him being that favored. So in any case, what happens is Lewis has a really, really difficult time at school. But one of the things that by the way, the name of the chapter in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, about his school experience is called Concentration Camp. He knows what that means. It's after World War II, but he's using that quite deliberately. He felt like he was in a concentration camp, like he had been in prison. Well, this idea where he says, he's trying to find some sense of happiness in his life. He's depressed, his life is very difficult for him, and suddenly he starts reading books. And he comes upon Squirrel Nutkin by Beatrix Potter. I want to read his description of what happened when he read this for the first time. I must admit that this book administered a great shock to me. It was a trouble, as best I can say. It troubled me with what I can only describe as the idea of autumn. It sounds fantastic to say that someone can be enamored of a season, but that is something like what happened. And as before, the experience was one of intense desire. And one went back to the book not to gratify the desire, because that's impossible, because how can anyone own autumn? But I went back to reawaken the desire, to go back to the place where I could find the longing for a world of fantasy. And in this experience also, there was the same surprise, the same sense of incalculable importance. It was something quite different from ordinary life, and even from ordinary pleasure. Something, I would say, like I was living in another dimension. Interesting observation. He starts with his brother, Warney. They start writing their own fantasy stories. Well, they weren't really fantasy. Lewis doesn't call them fantasy. He calls them stories about animals and clothes. And he starts writing this book called Boxen. His brother started writing his own type of book, and then they created the stories where they would, the two books would merge. And later on, this is a drawing that Lewis made of one of his main characters. In the book, a frog that was dressed up. But basically, if you can buy these now, I mean, they, you know, anything to make money off Lewis, right? And you might think that they're kind of imaginative Narnia sorts of stories. They're not. They're pretty boring. There's, you know, they're about frog kings and queens and, you know, political intrigue and things like that. And Lewis didn't think they were very good and didn't want people to read them. But that's how they got published, I suppose. And then Lewis starts reading poetry. He starts reading, in this case, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And he comes upon one particular poem. It's called Tegner's Drapa. And it's a story about Norse mythology. And the character in the middle here is a character named Baldur in Norse mythology. I don't know if you've ever heard of Baldur. Baldur is kind of like the god Apollo in Greek mythology. The god Apollo is beautiful. He's a person of arts. Everyone loves him. And in this story of Baldur, which is very, very famous, Loki, some of you who know the Avengers series and the trickster god, Loki has Baldur killed, gets Baldur killed. And there's a line in Wadsworth Longfellow's poem that reads like this. The voice cried out, Baldur the beautiful is dead." And notice what Lewis says, I was uplifted into a huge regions of northern sky. I desired with an almost sickening intensity something never to be described. I found myself already falling out of that desire and wishing I were back in it. Mm-hmm. He felt a deep, he kind of wept at the story. He knew nothing about all Baldur, but when he learned the story, he wanted to learn more. And he throws himself into Norse mythology. He starts reading everything he can about it. Notice Tolkien did the same thing. Tolkien was reading Norse mythology, and this is something that they had in common. And later, when they started the group called the Coalbiters, they were reading Norse mythology together around fires. And remember I said coalbiter meant they were sitting so close listening to each other telling stories. They were on top of the fire coals and biting the coals. They were so close because they loved the story so much. So Lewis kind of finds this pretty amazing. And what he feels like is like he's stepping through a door, like he's moving from one dimension to another dimension, like he's moving from a land where things are imperfect, where his mother is dead, where his father is distant, where his school is awful, and he can escape into Norse mythology and he can find a place of joy. He can find some hope, and not unlike, maybe a little bit like Dorothy. But those realms, those fantasy realms, also have danger with them, as we know with Dorothy, with the Wicked Witch of the West and the flying monkeys, which probably have caused many of us nightmares in the past.
Yes.
But so Lewis starts throwing himself into Norse mythology. This is an Arthur Rackham illustration of the Ring Cycle, which Lewis and Tolkien both were quite fond of. He also gets into Greek mythology. He starts reading it in the original Greek. He can quote it. He learns how to, we'll find out later, that he had a very, very special gift with languages, as did Tolkien. And one of the other types of mythology that we're probably less familiar with is Celtic mythology. But one of the things that he really gets from this mythology is the idea of talking animals. That's a big part of Celtic mythology, and you can see this is the deer king and a lot of animal imagery in Celtic mythology. And Lewis is pretty bereft. He's pretty lonely. The only guy in the world that he really has as a friend is his brother, until one day he goes back on holiday and his father tells him, hey, there's this guy named Arthur Greaves. I know the father, and he's very sick. He's in the hospital. He could use a visitor. Why don't you go see this guy? And Lewis goes in to visit him, and Lewis doesn't want to do this. He's just, you know, like any normal kid, you know, you tell him to do something, yeah, sure, you know. And he goes into the room, and it turns out Arthur is reading Norse mythology. And Lewis's first words to him are, "You like that?" And he goes, "Yeah, you like that?" And they were immediately hard and fast friends. Lewis says, borrows this idea from Aristotle. Aristotle says that there are people in this world, when we become friends with them, sometimes they are half of our own soul. Have you ever had a friend like that, so close? How do you know that they're that close? You can go away for 2 years and come back, and it's like you haven't missed a beat. Because you are the same person, or you're at least half of that person in some way. Arthur was his close and dear friend, and they wrote huge numbers of letters to each other. It's a book. It's so many. They kept their correspondence through all the years, and it's about 600 pages of letters that they had. They wrote up until the very last moment that they died. Arthur, I think, is interesting for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is that Lewis was now an atheist at this point in his life. He has given up on God. You pray to God to heal your mother. God doesn't do it. So what kind of good is that? What kind of God is that? Luther is kind of given up on all this stuff. Arthur was Christian, and Arthur would always try to convince him of things, and Lewis was always arguing with him. He said, "You know, Christianity, anything you believe in, that is like lies breathed through silver." And so they had this amazing argument going on. One of the things Lewis later on, when he converts back to Christianity, we'll talk about that. When he converts to Christianity, he finds that, you know, Lewis holds many sort of traditional views. One of those traditional views of that day is his attitudes towards women and their place in the world. And so when you read Mere Christianity, when I do that with my students, they always cringe at certain parts. He also talks about homosexuality, and he thinks that homosexuality is a choice, and he speaks negatively of it. However, Arthur was homosexual. And Lewis never broke off the relationship with him, and never seems to, in fact, on the other hand, seems to be very close and very understanding with him in this relationship, despite the fact that Arthur was homosexual. So Lewis is a bit of a puzzle on this point. He kind of holds traditional religious thinking of the 1940s and 50s, and yet at the same time, his attitude towards Arthur is one that's a really, it's a very beautiful relationship, and their letters are just, at times, very beautiful. In fact, I'll just, his last letter to Arthur, Lewis knew that he was dying, he writes Arthur his last letter, and he said, Arthur, my dear friend, I was going to come and see you. Now, alas, to never see you again. My heart, my world is empty." Right? His other part of his soul. He knew he wouldn't get to see him, and Arthur wouldn't get there in time. But Arthur was a very dear friend. Well, Lewis goes off. He gets a little bit older. He's having a terrible time at school, even though he's doing well. He's very bright. He's figuring things out. And his father decides that Lewis is not, and school is not for him in this traditional sort of way. So he decides to send Lewis to a guy named William T. Kirkpatrick. William T. Kirkpatrick had been a schoolmaster, but he was very old by this time. And Lewis is taken by him. And Lewis goes to the train station. He's taken in as a boarder at Kirkpatrick's house. Lewis will call him the Great Knock. Because he knocked him around a lot. And the original story of Lewis meeting the Great Knock was this one. He comes to the train station. When he gets to the train station, the Knock has these great big white sideburns, and he's a very formidable sort of character. Comes to greet him, and he says, "Come with me, Clive." And you know, "My name's Jack, and just come with me, Clive." And they start walking along the road, and Lewis is completely intimidated by this guy. He's incredibly bright. Lewis calls him the most rational being that ever walked the earth, right? Everything was about reason. He was an ardent atheist, which Lewis kind of thought, okay, good, I'm at least with somebody that I like, you know, I don't have to listen to this God talk. And so he's walking along with him, and he doesn't know what to say, and he's walking on, and he says, "Well, this is interesting countryside." And Kirkpatrick goes, "What do you mean interesting?" And he says, "Well, it's kind of wild." "What? look out there. Do you see anything wild? And there was nothing. It was a field with a bunch of rows and hedges and things. It's perfectly groomed. What do you mean wild? And Lewis goes, I was just making conversation. He says, well, at least make smart conversation. And so Lewis was immediately taken aback. And Kirkpatrick was one of these people who just always wanted Lewis to be clear, wanted Lewis to make strong arguments, wanted Lewis to think critically, wanted him to be smarter. One of those sorts of teachers that you really want your kids to have. Knocked him around intellectually for and Lewis turns him into a character in his Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, Uncle Diggory Kirk. Kirkpatrick was his name, and he will be a character in not only this story, but also he'll be a woman character in his Pilgrim Regress, another book where he's Mother Kirk. And Lewis is quite taken by him and says that he owes much of his life to him because Kirkpatrick taught him everything he knew, made him a brilliant scholar. Well, now Lewis is avidly atheist at this point, and I think this idea of joy, however, doesn't leave him. The idea of joy is not Christian for Lewis. It is universal. It is the human experience. And to give you an example of that, Bertrand Russell, one of the great atheists of the 20th century, writes in a letter to some of his friends. He says, when he's talking about the meaning of life, Bertrand Russell once writes, "The center of life for me is always that there I have this terrible pain and longing, a searching for something beyond this world, what contains something transfigured and infinite. It is a vision of what is beautiful. Is it God? I do not find it there. I do not think it can be found. But it is the deepest love of my life. It is the actual spring of life for me." Notice how similar that description is to Lewis's view of what joy is. Lewis thinks it's the universal human experience. Lewis famously says in his book, Mere Christianity, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience on earth can satisfy, the most probable explanation that I have is it must be from another world." In other words, if I am hungry, I go and eat. If I am tired, I go and sleep. But if I long for peace, and I long for happiness, and I long for longing, where does that come from? So, interestingly enough, Lewis is an avowed atheist. He's going to school. He wants to go on to, he's studying both philosophy and classical literature, especially medieval studies. And one day he's on a train going on his way to London, and he's in a train station. And he comes upon a book by George MacDonald called Phantastes. And he writes this about the book. "When I came upon the train station, I merely picked the book up for its cover." Sometimes have you ever done that and then found it to be a good book? A lot of times we don't. But he says, "I immediately started reading the book, and I fell into," this is a, it says it's a Gothic romance, it's kind of a fantasy sort of story. He says, "After a few hours, I knew that I had crossed into a great frontier. That night, my imagination was baptized." Interesting. It was like he felt the longing again. This, like reading this book, going into literature like he had as a youth, going into myth, going to other stories, he was drawn again to this land, or drawn against to this longing. But the world is a pretty terrible place, and Lewis's atheism would still struggle. Lewis wouldn't see the Christian implications of MacDonald. He was a Presbyterian pastor in England in the late 19th century, and wrote a lot of religious literature, and one of the early writers of fantasy. Both Tolkien and Lewis were very influenced by him. But Lewis would go off to World War I. Notice a pattern between him and Tolkien and Garrett. Lewis has much fewer friends than Tolkien had at this time, but one of his closest friends was a guy named Patrick Moore, or shorter as Paddy. Lewis and Patty were going off to war, and Patty's had a sister, Maureen, and a mother named Janie. And his mother was estranged from his father. The father didn't care about them at all. And Patty starts worrying. He says, I don't know what's going to happen to Mom should I die in the war. She will just be caught in poverty, because he was supporting her and things. And Lewis says, tell you what, if you die, I'll take care of your mother. If I die, you take care of my father. And good luck to you,
because I don't really like my father.
And Patty says, okay. The first week they're off at World War I, Patty dies. He disappears. We don't even know what happened, but probably a shell blew his body to smithereens. But he was lost. Lewis always kind of kept hoping that he would find his dear friend, but he never did. Tolkien had the same thing happen with the TCBS, his friends that were killed during World War I. So this great sense of loss. Tolkien and Lewis both wrote poetry about World War I. I told you about a poem yesterday about nature that he wrote during World War I. This is a poem, a book called Spirits in Bondage. He published it under the name of Clive Hamilton. Hamilton was his mother's maiden name, and he didn't want people to know it was his book. But it's a type of poetry. I want you to notice, however, he's clearly an atheist. The opening line, come, let us curse our master ere we die, for all our hopes in endless ruin lie. The good is dead, let us curse God on high. That is what World War I does to you. You curse God because God has let this happen. The joy is still there. Open the gates for me. Open the gates of peace, of the peaceful castle, rosy in the west, in the sweet dim Isle of Apples. If you are an Arthurian enthusiast, you'll know that the Isle of Apples is Avalon, where King Arthur and them live in this special place. In the sweet dim Isle of Apples, over the wide sea's breast, open the gates for me when I find thee, O country of dreams, beyond the tides of ocean, hidden and sunken away, out of the sound of battles, near to the end of day, full of dim woods and streams. He still longs for joy. Can't find it in God, but he looks for it in this sort of longing that seems, it's interesting to me that I think Lewis thinks that joy is more about a place than it is about a being. He calls it the home which I've never been to. Well, Lewis's quest for joy. So what do we have so far? I've gone over a lot, just a quick summary. You know, first of all, he has this sense of beauty in nature and in physical objects in the toy garden and the green hills. He comes in his imagination through books and poetry, mythology and fantasy stories. But there's a central conflict going on in Lewis's mind, and he acknowledges this in his autobiography. He says, reason, for example, suggests that a cruel world does not allow for a good God. Christianity is a false myth. It's lies breathed through silver. But in his imagination, he still longs for a land of dreams, like the one he finds in Norse, Greek, or Celtic mythology, that are true. And they point to something that he thinks is true joy. Now, there's a contradiction here. Myth is false if it's Christian. It doesn't point to joy. But myth is true if it's Greek or anything else, because it does point to joy. Notice he's now starting to struggle with this idea. Well, this becomes important because when Lewis gets done with the war, Lewis survives the war because, not unlike Tolkien, very early on in the war, he's standing in a trench and a bomb goes off right beside him. The two people standing beside him are blown to smithereens. They are killed. And he survives, but he takes shrapnel wounds and spends the rest of the war in the hospital, just like Tolkien. And that's probably the reason he survived. While he's in the hospital, he starts reading. Tolkien was creating his Elvish languages at this time. Lewis continues now reading more MacDonald. He's starting to read G.K. Chesterton, another very famous author, some of you may know. He's reading a guy named William Morris, who's a medievalist, who writes wonderful stories that are going to influence him. And when he comes out, he then goes and applies to Oxford. and he becomes a professor there. He first of all becomes a professor of philosophy because they had a position open, and then he applies for the English department and he becomes a professor of medieval literature. Tolkien only becomes a professor because after the war, so many young men had died that they waived the mathics part of the exam. He could never pass it. He was really awful at math. So Lewis passes the exam only because they didn't force him to do anything else with that. So what happens then, Lewis becomes a professor, and he suddenly, he's dealing with some of these contradictions in his own mind, but he's still an atheist. He's still one of the most famous atheists, really, at this. There's a lot of atheists at Oxford. But one day, Lewis said, he writes in a letter, I always have learned two things in life. You should never trust Catholics. And I don't like philologists. A philologist is somebody who studies language. And one day he meets J.R.R. Tolkien, who is both Catholic and a philologist. So, and Lewis would say, well, you know, be careful of what you hate, because you'll probably find somebody that you'll like that way. It's different than our world, I suppose. But one of the things that he does is Lewis becomes a part of this group called the Coalbiters, and they become an Inklings, with a group called Inklings. And they meet at the Eagle and Child pub. I've been there. This is my picture. We went, and they called it the Bird and the Baby, jokingly. And they would go there on Tuesday nights, and they would read each other's works. Lewis would read Narnia, and Tolkien hated it. And Tolkien would read Lord of the Rings, and Lewis loved it. And if it had not been for Lewis, Tolkien would have never really published the Lord of the Rings. But and if Lewis had listened to Tolkien, he would have never published Narnia, but he just didn't listen to him. So they would get into these great rows, but they had these great, they had this incredible friendship. And one of the people that was in that group was another guy named Hugo Dyson, another scholar from Reed's College, not far away, and he and Tolkien were good friends. And one night, Dyson and Tolkien and Lewis go for a walk on Addison's Way outside of Oxford. And they're walking along, and Lewis is kind of puzzling over the fact that both of these men are Christian. And Tolkien points out to him that many of the authors that he's reading, G.K. Chesterton, William Morris, George MacDonald, a lot of these authors that Lewis really likes are actually Christian. And Lewis couldn't point out why. He said, well, because they create great fantasy. And Tolkien says, well, why can they create great fantasy? And Lewis wasn't sure. So he was puzzled. And he said, and Tolkien then points out to him, and they walk till 4 o'clock in the morning. And Tolkien points out to him, he says, why is it that if Baldur in the Norse mythology dies and then is resurrected, which he is in the stories, you find great longing and joy in them? He says, yes, I do. And Bacchus, or Dionysus, the wine god, when he dies and is resurrected, you find great joy in them. Lewis says, yes, I do. Then why don't you like the Christian myth? And Lewis goes, I don't know. He was caught in a quandary. He was stuck for the first time. And it was really Tolkien who then said, isn't the enormous bliss in every myth, even if that myth comes true? He called Christianity the true myth. And Tolkien and Lewis both had the idea that truth of the universe must exist in all mythologies. Every story that we tell comes from our inner being. Now, there are some that don't. Some stories promote our own political power. Others promote our wealth. But as long as the story tells the truth of joy, where you find joy, going into a land where you find peace and happiness, as long as the story tells that, the truth of the divine is in that. And notice how remarkable that is in those days. In those days, who would else would it say myth is true, no matter what it is? Christians at that time would have said, oh, myth is falsehood. But Tolkien and Lewis come to the conclusion that myth is about truth, and that it points to joy, and it points to the divine being. Okay, Lewis says of that, he was like a fox flushed out of the woods, and he didn't know where to turn. What is it that he wanted? What was he going to do? Well, he was still a votary of the blue flower. He says, I must go towards beauty. What is beauty pointing me to? Joy is never what it's about. It's about what it points to. Okay. Now, I'm going to get into some kind of philosophical, narrow argument. So to do that, I think I'm going to take this off, and you should stand up and stretch for a minute, because we still have a little time. I'm getting hot. I don't know about you. Is it just me? Is it hot in here? Okay. Are the windows all open? We can kind of... Okay. So we'll stretch for a minute. While we're stretching, anybody have any questions about anything I've said so far? Yeah.
Well, that word, votary.
It means somebody who is avowed to or takes a vow to the blue flower, and that is to follow beauty in the flower. Votary is a person who makes a vow to follow something. And so he's going to follow the blue flower. He's going to follow beauty in his life. It's a good question. Other questions offhand?
Here.
Yeah.
I was waiting.
Oh, you're helping there? Any other, while we're just standing, take a few minutes to kind of get to this point. Did you have one?
No, I can say it's my wife.
Oh, you're waving at your wife? This is a great time to go join her if you want. You can be a voter as a blue flower and go over to your wife as a beautiful woman.
I don't like to.
That is what problem Lewis is going to talk about, but we'll hold on.
We've only been married 64 years.
Oh, okay, well then you're in good shape. all right, so let me talk about how this whole thing works. Lewis, at this point, goes on and he says, okay, he's like a fox that's been flushed out into the open, and he's scared. He doesn't know where to go. He knows that now, for the first time, that Christianity, his anxiety about Christianity is something that happened when he was a kid. Remember he said, I thought God was a magician. God would just answer my prayers. Lewis later will say in his last book that's published that he writes is called Letters to Malcolm. He makes up a character, a nephew named Malcolm, and he writes letters to him and writes them back and forth. And in there he says, I do not pray to change God's mind. I pray to change my mind. What is it that when we pray, we must enter into a space of humility before the divine and then seek what it is that God wants for us? For example, like in the Lord's Prayer, when you say, forgive us our debts as we forgive others, right? And so the idea of the Lord's Prayer is to change yourself. May your kingdom come. May your will be done. Those sorts of things. So Lewis is struggling. He's reading a book by a guy named Samuel Alexander called Space, Time, and Deity. And Alexander makes an interesting distinction. He says that there's two ways of thinking about how the world works. He says one way is that we come to know things through experience. And the most important experiences that we have are about joy. And so now you can see Lewis, he's drawn to this idea. Okay, joy, this is what he's wondering about. He's been pursuing this. And the experiences of joy are really important. But the problem is, says Alexander, is that as soon as we start talking about joy, we kill it. We destroy it. And how? Let me give you an example about this. When I was young, I don't know how many of you are of my era or how long this kept going on, but I grew up in a small rural town, Odessa, Washington, not far from here, and I lived kind of on the edge of town, and off to the edge of town there was these little ponds. And every spring, the great thing about these ponds was that there was tadpoles in them. And I got to know tadpoles. I love tadpoles. They had these long tails, they were trying to kind of translucent, the tails got shorter, the body got longer, all of a sudden legs and arms popped out. I just thought this was the coolest thing in the world. And I would, you know, put them in jars, bring them home, try to see how they fed, try to feed them, you know, flies, whatever. So I learned about frogs by the joy of experiencing them. For me, it was a thrill. Have you ever seen a little kid just watch an ant? You know, the ant's going along and the kid's there. They're completely consumed. We go, you know, we don't want the ants in the house. And so it's a very different sort of experience. So what happens then is I go off to high school. And back in the day, when I was in high school, they bring in the live frogs. Remember that? Kind of like E.T. Remember that scene in E.T.? They bring in the live frogs, and now I've got to take the chloroform and kill the frog. And then I'm going to dissect the frog. Now, I can learn a lot about dissecting a frog that I can't learn about being in experience. I can see the heart. I can see the, you know, different organs. I can do that. But I have to kill the frog in order to make the thing work, right? To think about it. And that's what Alexander's point was. For Lewis, this was an important distinction, because one of the things that he's pursuing in life is trying to figure out, how do I get joy? How do I have joy? And he kept thinking about it. And as you think about it, you lose it. For example, if I give an example, my wife Peggy sitting up in the front, if I give her a kiss, an amorous kiss, that's a nice experience. But if I go to her and I kiss her and I say, oh, this is really fun. This is a great kiss. that would not be any fun, right? She wouldn't enjoy that, right? You know? If I'm talking about it, if I'm thinking about what I'm kissing, you know, now I need to get lost in her, you know, in the sense that I love her and I love, and the kiss is the experience versus thinking about it. So this is important for Lewis because he doesn't want to kill the frog, so to speak. So how do we get to the point of having some joy? And one of the things he realizes is that joy is about just being, embracing the moment, being a part of, well, this is my family. That's Peggy, my youngest son, the winemaker, the neonatal nurse, and my son, the filmmaker. And we were in Ireland, and we had just gone to Colum Kill's old monastery, and we had this really, really long hike, and we were all really, really thirsty. And my wife and my daughter especially don't like Guinness, and we went into a pub, and I bought 5 Guinness, and we went outside, and we said, we're going to drink a Guinness. And that was so much fun, right? But they started liking Guinness, probably more because it was such a fun moment, right, for us, right? We kind of got lost in the moment. And if I start talking about, you know, Guinness is good because it has, you know, it's good for you, it has only, you know, it's high in protein, it's low in alcohol, and I said, that wouldn't work, right? Notice what Lewis is trying to suggest. How do we experience things? And Lewis doesn't give away his answer until the end, the last page of the book. And this is Lewis's description of how joy works. He says, what in the end is joy about? For after all, that is what this story has been mainly about. I tell you the truth, the subject has lost all interest to me. I'm no longer interested in trying to understand joy. Since I became a Christian, I cannot even complain like Wordsworth that the visionary gleam has passed away. I believe if the thing were at all worth recording, this old stab, this old bittersweet, has come to me as often and as sharply since my conversion as it has any other point in my life. So what is it about? I now know that the experience is not simply a state of mind. And it has never been of a great, that was always what was of great importance to me. That's what I gave it. It was, joy was valuable only as a pointer to something other and outer. It is as if I was in a dark wood wandering. Does anybody know what that book is from? I was in a dark wood wandering. Dante's Inferno. Yeah. I was in a dark wood wandering. Notice he's quoting Dante here. When I was in dark wood wandering, it was as if I was in these woods, and suddenly I was lost, lonely, hungry, not knowing what to do. And suddenly I come upon a pointer, something other and outer, a sign. While that other was in doubt, the pointer naturally loomed large in my mind. But when we are lost in the woods, the sight of a signpost is a great thing. who first sees it will cry, look. And the whole party gathered around and stares at the sign. And when they have found the road and are passing signpost after signpost, you hardly take notice of them. They will encourage us, and we shall be grateful for whatever authority has set them up, but we shall not stop and stare, not so much, not on this road, though they are pillars of silver and letters of gold. We would be home in Jerusalem. But of course, it's not like I don't catch myself stopping on the roadsides trying to pick up shiny objects now and then. So what is Lewis telling us about joy? Joy is something that points beyond itself. It's something that if we get caught up in the types of joy that we can control, he's going to call those small J joy. There are certain joys that we can control. If I drink a Guinness, I like that. Guinness gives me joy. Would it be true then if I drank six of them, I would be happier? I certainly would be something. Whether it's happy or well, yeah, I suppose it would be happy. But I wake up in the morning and I wouldn't be happy. Notice that the small J joy is always momentary. You find that happiness, you grasp onto it for the moment, and you hang on to it, and then it's gone. It's not something that lasts. If my wife and I have an argument, and she's wrong and I'm right, and she gets mad at me and says, "You go sleep downstairs." And I go downstairs and I'm not happy and I want to be happy, I go to the fridge and I drink those six Guinness, right? And then I'm happier. But in the morning I wake up and I'm not happy, right? You know, because my wife's mad at me because they're cans laying all over the living room or whatever. And she's still not happy with me. No, the true happiness is if I had gone to her and we find what our problem is and we work it out. And we find where the true joy is and we don't manufacture it. Then I have lasting happiness. Harmony in the universe, for Lewis, is what it's all about. God created the world, says Lewis. And Tolkien believed this as well. And when God created the world, God left God's fingerprints all over everything. And when we see the fingerprint, we see it pointing to something, but we're not sure what it is. But it's always the simple, the ordinary, the joyful, that heartache, that bittersweet holding of the baby and hoping for the future but knowing the reality of the world and still longing for something better. Or when you enter a fantasy story, that you can, when you enter the story, you feel that sort of longing for that place where things are different, where the elves actually take care of the woods, where the children, the Pevensey children in Narnia, actually care about the animals, unlike Miraz, who wants to kill them, the talking animals, because he wants to control the land, right? That is the joy that we ultimately seek. Lewis says, when he finds this joy, the discovery flashed like a new light back on my whole life. I saw all that was waiting and watching for joy, all my vain hopes to find some mental content, dissecting the frog, saying this is it or that is it, and that was not it. All that such of watching and waiting could never find that true joy, that quiver that comes to my diaphragm. I should never have to bother again about images or sensations. I knew now that they were merely a mental track of the passage of joy, like signs that were going before me. Joy is not the wave, but it is the imprint of the wave upon the sand as it disappears. It's seeing something. It is the awe of seeing the beauty of the world. And joy is that moment when you lose yourself in something else. And you don't matter, and that other thing matters more than anything in the world. When I hold my child and I'm feeling joy, I'm not thinking about how happy I am. I'm not thinking about, you know, what gain I'm going to get out of this. I am just lost in that child. Or when you walk across the Grand Canyon's ridge and you're lost in a moment of wonder. Or when you find, well, it can also be in bittersweet moments, when I sat at my father's bedside and prayed with him one last time and watched him slip into death. That is a great bittersweet. Everything suddenly is hope and bittersweet and anguish and longing. It's the wave imprint upon the sand. Those are the moments that Lewis is talking about. Lewis says, joy itself was always saying, it is not I. I am only a reminder. I am what is waking you up from the world which has cast an enchantment upon you. Enchantments, Lewis says, are not only to make magic, but they're to break magic. And the world has a destructive magic. It says that you want power, you want fame, and you want wealth. You want security. But you need fantasy or story to wake you up from that. That's the truth that wakes you up. Mm-hmm. Lewis says, joy is the land of peace beyond the horizon. If we simply enjoy it, it will remain with us for a moment, but it will help us understand life for a lifetime. Lewis writes this, looking at the Gospels, it seems that our Lord Jesus finds our desires not too strong. Our desires are not too strong, but they are simply too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy lies right before us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum, and he can't imagine what a holiday at the sea might be like. We are far too easily pleased as human beings. In speaking of this desire for our far-off country, which we find in ourselves, even now, I feel a certain shyness. I am almost committing an indecency. I am trying to rip open an inconsolable secret that lies within each one of us. The secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it nostalgia or adolescence. The secret also which pierces, which with such sweetness that when in very intimate conversation, the mention of it comes up and it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves. The secret we cannot hide and yet cannot tell anyone else, that what we really long for is just simply the joy of being in somebody's presence and not all the other baggage that comes with it. We cannot hide it, because our experience is constantly suggesting it, and we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of its name. Our commonest expedient is to call it beauty and behave as if that has settled the matter. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust them alone. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was the longing for the thing that it was pointing to. These things, the beauty, the memory of our past, are good images of what we really desire, but they are mistaken for the thing itself. They turn into dumb idols, breaking our hearts, for they are not the thing. They are only the scent of the flower we have not yet found, the echo of the tune we have not yet heard, and news from a country we have not yet visited. It was I who was most happiness when I longed the most, says Lewis. The sweetest thing in my life has been to long and to find a place where that beauty comes from. Let me just tell you a little bit about the end of Lewis's life, and then open up for questions. Lewis, like Tolkien, was a very simple man. Even though he became wealthy the money he got from the Narnia Chronicles and all the other things, he put into a fund that his friend, who he called Owen Barfield, who was his anti-friend, a person who believed exactly the opposite of what he believed, that was his dearest friend, Lewis put his entire estate in Owen Barfield's hands, had him administer his estate. And he had a lot of money, and he took care of orphans because he thought lots of children were were reading his books. But he says, this is how he sums up his life. And it's interesting, when he meets Tolkien challenges Lewis to write a science fiction novel, and Tolkien would write three of them out of The Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength. The main character of the story is a man named Gransom Elfwin. Elfwin means lover of elves, and he's a philologist, and he's Tolkien. The main character of the science fiction trilogy is Tolkien, who goes to these other planets. He thought it would be good to have a philologist on other planets because they could figure out languages to speak, right? So that's how that goes about. So I recommend that. Tolkien, in return, Lewis challenged Tolkien to write a time travel novel, which he started, but he never got to because he was too busy writing The Lord of the Rings. Lewis, then during World War II, would become really famous because of the book Mere Christianity. I highly recommend George Marsden's book called the C.S. Lewis Mere Christianity, a biography. It's a biography about the book Mere Christianity and why Lewis has remained so popular since the war. He did these radio broadcasts to try to give hope to people in England who were quite discouraged about the war and all the things that were going on, and then those radio broadcasts became his book, Mere Christianity. Lewis also, of course, becomes famous for the Narnia Chronicles, and one of the things I'm going to talk about more in my next lecture is Lewis was an avid, as much as Tolkien was an avid naturalist and concerned about trees and forests, and Lewis felt bad about that, Lewis is also very avid against animal cruelty. And he actually wrote a treatise for the anti-vivisectionists and people who were using animals for treatments and using them to experiment on. And Lewis said that he hated the idea of tormenting animals in any way. He loved mice. And his favorite character in the Narnia Chronicles is Rikki-Tikki, the mouse that some of you may know about. And Lewis tells the story that when he was getting ready to call it a day in his office in Magdalen College, he would know it was time to go home because the mice would come out into his office. And he would talk to them. He never set traps. He really felt that the mice should have a good life. And so he took care of them. I know some of you don't feel the same way about that, but Lewis is a very avid animal rights activist, and it's very interesting. That's something that gets often ignored about Lewis. Lewis would meet a young woman by the name of Joy Davidman. They'd meet in 1952 while he's writing the Narnia Chronicles. He would write his biography in 1955. He would completely, Surprised by Joy is not about her. It's about Joy, but it's ironic that her name is Joy. She was an atheist Jewish communist, and she was married to another man, had two children, and kind of starts a love affair with Lewis, and this becomes a huge scandal, right? As you can imagine, people weren't quite sure what to do. I highly recommend Abigail Santamaria's book about Joy. It's fabulous. It gives you a lot of interesting insight into Lewis and her. They would marry in 1956. She would get cancer. It's a very odd story because she would break away from her husband for a variety of reasons, some of which she said was like alcoholism, and he was supposedly philandering. But if you read this book, it seems like Joy was also interested in Lewis, so it's a little bit of goes both ways. As soon as she kind of breaks away from her husband, she can't stay in England because she only has a visa for so long, and Lewis marries her in a civil ceremony and doesn't tell anybody about it so that she can stay. But they're not really all that close. He's really interested in her mind. He liked her as a person. She liked to spar with him. She was very bright. She had been a screenwriter in Hollywood. She had written a number of books and was a successful novelist herself. But eventually they would slowly fall in love, and then Joy would get cancer, And Lewis then would marry her in a real ceremony. Tolkien was very hurt by this because he didn't know that Lewis had married her originally. And when Lewis wants to have the church marry her, the church won't do it because you can't marry somebody who's been divorced. And she just had gotten a divorce, and a priest agrees to marry them. He's also a faith healer in the Anglican Church. He prays for joy, and she goes into remission. But the priest is almost kicked out of the Anglican Church because he does it against the wills of the bishop, and he's sent off to a little tiny parish out in the countryside close to Scotland. So that's what happens if you go against them. Joy would start to have a relapse, and Lewis and Hurd decide, okay, what are we going to do? Well, let's go one more trip. And if you could go anywhere in the world and you have one more trip, where would you go? You'd think Lewis and Joy would go to Israel or something like that. They go to Greece. And they go to the ancient mythic places of Delphi and all those places. She falls into becoming quite ill, and she would die in 1960. Lewis would then adopt both of her boys, David and Douglas. And the father in the United States would not take them in. This is the epitaph that Lewis wrote for her. I think it's quite beautiful. Here the whole world, stars, water, air, and field and forest, as they were reflected in a single mind, like cast-off clothes, have left behind in ashes, yet with hopes that she, reborn from holy poverty in Lenten lands hereafter, may resume them on her Easter day. Joy had converted to Christianity because of Lewis's writings. The two boys, David, would go on and become a Hasidic Jew and would not have as much to do with Lewis's legacy. And Douglas would become the owner of the kind of the Narnia franchise, and he's still alive, and he's the executive producers on all the movies and those sorts of things. Lewis would write a very famous book called A Grief Observant. Notice the name, N.W. Clerk. He wrote it under a pseudonym because he didn't want people to know that this book was about about Joy's death. It's a beautiful book. It's heartrending. And T.S. Eliot, who worked at Faber and Faber, figured out that it was Lewis, but they didn't put Lewis's name on the book until after Lewis had died. Lewis would die 3 years after Joy, and these boys would be quite young. But Lewis would also go on to write many other very famous books, like his own Dante's Inferno version of that, The Great Divorce. And he would die on November 22nd, 1963. And if you remember that day, almost nobody knew that Lewis had died because Kennedy had been assassinated on November 22nd. And Aldous Huxley also died on the same day. And so for a long time, people didn't know that Lewis had actually died. I've been to Lewis's tomb in Headington Quarry, and his brother, and the thing men must endure their going hence is a line from Shakespeare, whom he had a moderate relationship with, but it happened to be on the calendar the day his mother had died, and he and Warney both thought that was a nice epitaph, so they put it on there. And Warney was buried in his tomb. Joy was cremated, and her ashes were cast at Headington Quarry Trinity Church there as well. Joy had helped him write his favorite book, Till We Have Faces. It's about the Psyche and Cupid myth, and Lewis thought this was the best book that he ever wrote, and it's one that almost nobody reads. I read it with students, and students are pretty taken by it. It's a really beautiful and interesting book. Has anybody read it? A few people? Yeah, would you agree?
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
It's magnificent.
Yeah, it's really great. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it to you. Although a few things about Lewis's legacy. In Ireland, of course, they have all sorts of things. They used Narnia and other things to fight the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, and they would put up Narnia murals over the top of IRA murals in order to counter the sort of violence and things there. So it was kind of interesting. A picture I took in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey, Lewis and Tolkien now have their own little slab there. Of course, really popular movies that have come out lately. Also Amazon, is it Netflix? Amazon's doing Tolkien's books again, and Netflix is going to do all of the Chronicles of Narnia, remaking them, but these were pretty popular movies that came out of late. There's huge Aslan sculptures in Belfast, You might have seen the movie Shadowlands, which is done in a couple versions, and there's even a play that's about Joy and Lewis. There's a few things that are not quite accurate in the films, but Richard Attenborough, who did the Sir Richard Attenborough, a great filmmaker, did a really nice job with those. But I like both of these versions of the film. There's schools that are named after Lewis. There are books that suggest he should be a saint. There is an entire nature preserve in England, the Wildlife Trust outside of Oxford, which is named after Lewis. And I love this quote. What we call human power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. Lewis was very distrustful of governments. He was often asked to become part of political parties. He always refused that. He always felt that it was important to try to work for the best positive change outside of being a part of a political party. But why don't I stop with that, and we have a few minutes for questions or any comments that you might have. Is there any thoughts, observations? I can tell you that the other great controversy while you're thinking around Lewis's life was that after Patty died, Lewis did take in Janie Moore. She was 20 years his senior. Some people have suggested that she was like a mother figure to him. Many people have suggested, people that knew him, that Lewis, who was an atheist at the time that he took her in and took care of her for the rest of his life, had a long affair with her. But that's debated in the scholarly world. So you'll hear, but they were living in the same house. And so some of Lewis's closest biographers who knew him well have suggested that there was an affair that was going on. Lewis says in Surprised by Joy, there is one thing that I will not talk about, and that is Janie Moore. And so he refuses to talk about it. We know that they had a pile of letters, and Lewis burned them immediately upon her death. So we don't really have any sense of what their correspondence was about. So we'll just let that controversy sit there. But yeah.
Just to clarify, Patty was the friend who died
in World War I. Okay. Yeah. And so he took in Janie and Maureen. And when Lewis died, it's interesting, Maureen came to visit him, and she had married a duke in England. And Lewis had been completely unconscious for a number of days, and they were just kind of waiting for him to die. And she walked into the room, and he sat up, says, "My Lady Maureen." And she says, "Do you recognize me?" He says, "Of course, how could I forget you?" And then he had this really lucid moment, and then he drifted off and died after that. So it's kind of an interesting sort of relationship that he had with Maureen. Any other sorts of questions or thoughts? I won't belabor it. Have a good night. Thanks for coming.